The Spotlight.
Systemic racism holding back black Americans. That is the assessment of a U.S. civil rights group, the National Urban League, who has said that the median household income for black people in the U.S. is 37% lower than that of white people. Why does racism in all of its forms, like in this case income, still persist in the U.S. to the extent that it does? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why it is difficult for people of color to overcome systemic racism in the U.S. in all of its forms.
An annual report by a New York-based civil rights organization has once again turned the spotlight on systemic racism and bias in the United States. The National Urban League's report showed that African Americans, despite making economic and health gains, still get just about 74% of what white people enjoy in the country. The organization demonstrates how difficult it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism.
These numbers change so little and so slowly. What it tells me is that this institutional disparity based on race seems to be built into American society.
The findings show the median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people and are less likely to benefit from home ownership. The report also touches upon educational gaps.
Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher-paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college.
On voting rights, the report says state legislatures have been restricting voting access in districts with large populations of black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. The report also points to U.S. Justice Department statistics saying black people have been more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters, and three times more likely to be jailed if arrested. The grim findings come nearly 2 years after the U.S. underwent a major reckoning on racism following the brutal killing of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. His death ignited nationwide protests and demands for equality and end to police brutality against people of color. Nonetheless, the National Urban League's report has highlighted the fact that racial inequality in the U.S. is deep-rooted. It stems from years of injustice and institutionalized racism against African Americans and other minority groups, which worsened during Donald Trump's presidency. Anti-racism demonstrations have also failed to bring about any tangible change in previous years.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Joseph Richardson, professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland from Laurel, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. And I have to say, if you did not catch on, that this was a report by the civil rights group National Urban League. So obviously your opinion of that organization is very important. But basically, one of the conclusions it has reached is that systemic racism is holding back black Americans. And it says black people in the U.S. are trailing white people in critical areas. That includes wealth, education, social justice, health, and civic engagement. Are you surprised at that, first of all?
No, I'm not surprised. And those who are surprised have not been paying attention to U.S. history. That is to say, when the European settlers and colonists began invading in North America in the 1500s and 1600s, they set up a society that was exclusive. It was only tended to benefit those who were like themselves. They liquidated the indigenous population for the most part, and then handcuffed Africans and dragged them across the Atlantic to be slaves. And we have not been able to transcend that original sin to the point where, as your reporter suggested, the prisons are overflowing with black Americans. Black Americans are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, that is to say, executed by the arm of the state. Black people are more likely to be shot down in the streets by the police forces. And with regard to housing discrimination, the latest revelation is that if a black person is trying to sell their home, they find they can get more for their home if they take down the pictures on the walls of their black relatives and leave the walls bare, or put up pictures of those who are defined as white. I can think of no worse example of the kind of white supremacy that obtains in the United States of America.
Joseph Richardson, this National Urban League actually produced the first state of black America in its report that, based on what it said, it captured the plight of the people who had been victims of systemic racism since arriving, as it said, in the shores of the U.S. And when you take a look at the year that report was published, it was back in 1976. Of course, Gerald Horn there goes back even further. When you have organizations like this and similar to this issuing out alarm bells and describing how this systemic racism is going on, and it's still, based on its most recent report, is even in some sense gotten worse, then why aren't there any action plans set forward? Or have they, and it's just not working?
I believe that there have been action plans that have been set forward, and there are many scholars who have addressed the wealth gap in this country. We only need to look at the work of economist Sandy Darity at Duke University, who has been making the argument for reparations, and we've heard discussions and policies recommending and advocating for reparations across this nation. But if to hark back onto the work of Dr. Darity found just in terms of the wealth gap in America, and it's quite interesting that we often emphasize the educational gaps, but what Dr. Darity found in terms of the differences in wealth is that white Americans, even those who have not graduated from high school and dropped out of high school, have greater wealth than black Americans who have a college degree. And so his argument is that there really isn't a way to educate ourselves out of the great wealth gap and disparities that we have between blacks and whites without having another form of remediation, and that would be in the form of reparations. Because as you mentioned, that report was made in 1976, and not much has changed in terms of black wealth over the past 50 years. And in fact, we know that during the Obama administration, black Americans actually lost more wealth because much of our wealth has been tied to home ownership. And so that intergenerational transference of wealth hasn't happened in the same way for black Americans as it has traditionally benefited white Americans in this country.
One of the most alarming, at least in terms of what I saw, Gerald Horn, of this report is how it talked about voting rights. And taking a look at the statement that it made there, it was very interesting in the way that it described it. And it said that it was actually an anti-democratic move that began after the 2008 election, when black voting rates actually matched white voting rates for the first time, which catapulted Barack Obama into office. This sounds an awful lot like a UN report that recently came out talking about voting rights of minorities denied in parts of the U.S., mentioning Texas, as one of those states. That sounds like black voting is being, or black votes are being suppressed. Is that what this is about, which is resulting in gerrymandering? And perhaps you can describe that for us.
Well, gerrymandering is the process whereby congressional districts or state legislative districts are drawn in such a way as to oftentimes dilute the effectiveness of the black vote. That is normative, particularly in a state like Texas. You also need to realize that one of the reasons that this takes place is that the black voter tends to vote against conservatives, vote against the Republicans, vote against the right wing at a higher rate than any other demographic category, oftentimes reaching 9-1. And so it is in the material interest of the conservatives, of the Republicans, to try to dilute, if not obliterate, black voting power. If that were the only problem that we faced, of course, that would be formidable. But to return to the economic question, there is the question of employment discrimination. You've had recently attempts to pass laws, for example, to prevent employers from discriminating against people who have hair like mine. That is to say, it's quite usual, quite typical for black women to face discrimination because of having hair like this, a category that they have nothing to do with. That is the essence, obviously, of blatant discrimination. And the fact that you have to pass a law to address that says more than I could ever articulate.
Well, if you want to talk about the economy, this is definitely an eye-opener. And it's not new news. Joseph Richardson, I don't know if you're even aware of it. Hopefully you are, and perhaps you can spread the word. But there was one report that came out in 2020 by a major U.S. Banking group, Citigroup, that said the U.S. economy has lost $16 trillion because of discrimination. Now this, again, it came out in 2020. There was another report that came out that was cited by the San Francisco Federal Reserve President Mary Daly that said that the racial and ethnic inequities have cost the U.S. economy some $51 trillion. Now I do have to say this is not just lost revenue from blacks, but also people of color. But still, it's a really large figure. You would think the U.S. government would address this, and I think at some point Joe Biden did address that in his presidential campaign, that he is aware of this.
Well, while President Biden may be aware of it, again, it takes the political will of our policymakers in order to implement and execute policies that will actually effectively address these issues. And so, again, I think what you're saying is has an historical context to it. The work of Lisa Cook, an economist at Michigan State, does some really rigorous scholarship in terms of black patents and the number of patents that have been stolen from black scientists and inventors, and what that has cost the U.S. economy, I think contributes in many respects to the number that you just noted. But we also have to think in terms of and the number of people that are not leaving, that are unable to get a college education, who can create and contribute to the economy by being scientists and incubators of innovation, and how that has impacted black Americans as well, in addition to preventing us from entering into small businesses by preventing us from getting loans. And we recently saw in Wells Fargo, just in terms of black wealth again, that far more black applicants were denied recently from getting home loans and particularly refinancing loans than white applicants. And so all of this in combination, whether it's the lack of our being able to build our human capital, which ultimately may tie into our social and financial capital, plays an instrumental role in accumulating our wealth. And so the statistics that you just noted, I don't find them surprising at all, understanding and knowing the context of the way structural racism has played out in terms of even the scientists and innovation in terms of patents among black people in this country.
Sure. And of course, Gerald Horn, I do have to say that this is not something that the U.S. is just the U.S. experiencing, but also a phenomenon around the world. When this report was described, Gerald Horn, it said, in different, mind you, websites, it said that the report came nearly 2 years after the U.S. experienced what it called a major reckoning on racism in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Now, we know that this type of racism has existed before. Do you agree, or why do you think the reason is that the report or the description of the report is stated as such, that it comes after what it calls a major reckoning after the death of George Floyd or the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say that it was a reckoning. I'm not so sure it was a major reckoning, because if it was a major reckoning, we would not be discussing the dismal report that's now on our agenda. For those who may not recall, in May 2020, the black man known as George Floyd was executed on tape by police officers in the state of Minnesota. That led to mass protests across the country and indeed in many parts of the world. That is the so-called major reckoning that took place. But it takes more, I'm afraid to say, than a spate of demonstrations to erode the encrusted bigotry that has accumulated over the decades and over the centuries in the United States of America. And in fact, I dare say that given the fact that inflation is now racking the U.S. economy, and indeed the economies of a goodly number of advanced capitalist countries, you can expect these kinds of dismal reports to be issued regularly, because when there are economic downturns, oftentimes the rate and regularity of racism accelerates. And I'm afraid to say that that's maybe on the agenda as we speak.
Well, it's very alarming, I would think, Joseph Richardson, when you take a look at what the report has said regarding representation in Congress. And it said, people of color made up 90% of the population growth in North Carolina, 95% of the population growth in Texas, yet the communities of color in those states have seen decreased representation in Congress. Now, if I'm in the White House and I'm reading this, I should be alarmed, because what if this were to spread to more states? Because as this report indicated, for example, you have a major increase in the number of populations that are the spending that occurs from consumers. And at the same time, you have, for example, incomes that are 37% less than that of white people, as is said, for black people. My question being, there needs to be an equality of some sorts to be applied here, whether it's a representation in Congress, income, and what have you. Do you see any major movements to that effect?
No, but I would say that we have not had the same level of representation in Congress that was reflective of the black population since Reconstruction. We had far more senators and congressmen that were of African-American descent in Congress during Reconstruction than we've had since then. So, I mean, there's a historical context to this, which isn't just playing out recently. I mean, we're talking about well over 100 years. So, and just in terms of, again, we need to think about in terms of who we are voting for. How are we casting our vote? Dr. Horn mentioned that we typically vote against conservatives, but we also have to revisit, just in terms of our own economic health and survival, what has the Democratic Party done to deliver our vote? And we have several scholars that have made the argument that maybe African Americans should form more of a voting bloc than to just freely give their vote over to the Democratic Party, because it hasn't resulted in any kind of economic advancement for Black Americans, whether in terms of economically or even in terms of our civil rights agenda. And so, again, I think we need to retrench and think more critically about what has the Democratic Party done for Black Americans in terms of advancing our economics, advancing the health of our communities, our life expectancy, and the educational systems, as well as the criminal justice system, which we haven't seen many gains for African Americans, regardless of what party we choose to elect and place into office. And so maybe it is time for us to think about how we can leverage our vote in terms of leveraging our vote with who needs our vote the most in terms of what we will get out of it and in terms of placing it, specific candidates in office and not thinking specifically along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gerald Horn, what do you think about that? At this point, do you see the Democratic Party failing in delivering on its promises, especially when it comes to either people of color or African-Americans or blacks? Or do you see that the Democratic Party is not doing that, and therefore there needs to be another kind of representation for, and I'm going to put people of color as a whole, and then blacks or African-Americans specifically?
Well, I would like to add another factor, which is that if you look historically, the crucial and critical factor that helps to propel black people in particular forward has been the global context. It's no accident that U.S. apartheid, legalized discrimination and racism, began to retreat 70-odd years ago when the United States is under international pressure as African and Caribbean nations are coming to independence and the socialist camp is bidding for influence amongst those nations. The U.S. decides that the better part of wisdom is to try to execute an agonizing retreat away from the more egregious and horrible aspects of Jim Crow. I agree that left to its own devices, the road ahead for black people will be quite rocky. But that's where our international allies, particularly our allies and friends in Iran, can intervene, because just as our friends in Iran are under pressure from Washington and from the right wing and from those who rule the United States, black people are under pressure from the right wing as well. So I would urge our friends overseas, not least in Iran, to speak out on our behalf, because that would be in your interest and that would be in our interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that. Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies from the University of Houston. Thank you so much. Joseph Richardson, thank you, Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the month of Reformation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. I would like to emphasize to my fellow Muslim sisters and brothers that fasting is not just abstaining from food, drink, smoking, and sexual activities. You know, some people seem to think very superficial when it comes to fasting. They know it's wajib, it's obligatory, but they feel that, you know, it's only these three, four things that we have to give up. And this is it. We would like to say, while we're fasting, we should also try our best to reform our behavior and attitude towards others. There are many things which will not legally, technically, invalidate our fasting, but they surely are against the spirit and purpose of fasting. For example, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said that lying, backbiting, and lustful glances destroy the spirit of fasting. Hunger and thirst should not become an excuse to be angry and discourteous in our behavior. This goes completely against the purpose of fasting itself. Let us not be those who gain nothing out of fasting but hunger and thirst. Brothers and sisters, sometimes we feel that
since I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, it's justified for me to be rude to others, to yell at others for small little things, insignificant things, right? Something, you know, which is really trivial, but, you know, I find it for myself a license to be able to insult someone. And it happens many a times between families, right, at home. Now, you're expecting that, oh, my brother or my sister should realize that I'm fasting, so they should not do this, this, and that. And as soon as they do it, you get riled up. You become angry, and you start yelling at them. Brothers and sisters, know that. This was a test from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because you know, in addition to staying hungry and thirsty and not having sexual activities, you were also expected not to get angry for trivial things. So this is something we all need to keep in mind and inshallah try to practice, you know, very carefully throughout this holy month of Ramadan. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about the month of Reformation, the month of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, right? And we said that some people who are very superficially looking at this blessed month, they think that staying hungry and thirsty and not having sexual activities suffices to qualify to be someone who is fasting. We said no. While this is something that you are required by Allah to do, there are other things too, in terms of your akhlaq, in terms of your manners, in terms of your lifestyle, in terms of your thoughts even, that need to be checked in this holy month of Ramadan. Now, of course, it can be argued that they need to be checked throughout the year, but the holy month of Ramadan is an opportunity where you should take it up as a challenge. So one of those deficiencies you may have, and you know about it, you know, like we mentioned anger before, similarly, you know, there could be other vices that we may have, try to control them. The spirit of the holy month of Ramadan is different from this superficial understanding of staying hungry and thirsty. The spirit of the month of Ramadan is to become and to become the in charge and to come into the control of your own nafs and your own self and be subservient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the real sense of the word. This is what we're after, right? And trust me, brothers and sisters, sky is the limit. There are three levels explained by, you know, for someone who keeps fast, there are three levels explained by some of our scholars of akhlaq. Number one is the basic level. Number two is the moral level. Number three is the spiritual level, right? And we know that not everyone is equal in piety. We're definitely going to talk about these three levels, but know that it is like you do your high school and then you go to your do your bachelor's and then you do your master's and then you do your PhD, then you do your doctorate. Can you say all of them are educated to the same degree? Of course not. Similarly, somebody who is fasting in the month of Ramadan, they should be careful of whether they're just doing the basic level of fasting or the higher level, which is the moral level, or the highest level, which is the spiritual level. So this is something you should keep in your mind, and we will discuss these things in future episodes. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living of electric and gas and petrol and food is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify, week by week, the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country, or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women, in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallofabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called a comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dezengov shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
Watchdogs noted that the investment came after Kushner used his position in the White House to advance Saudi interests and shield the regime from accountability for the Khashoggi murder. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "His Cashing In. Kushner firm gets $2 billion from Saudi fund run by Crown Prince." Stay tuned for more. A private equity firm created by former White House advisor and Trump son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has reportedly secured a $2 billion investment from a sovereign wealth fund directed by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a deal that watchdog groups and lawmakers viewed as part of Kushner's effort to cash in on his favorable treatment of the brutal Saudi regime. The New York Times reported recently that Kushner's new firm, Affinity Partners, netted the investment 6 months after the end of the Trump administration, despite objections from the Saudi fund's advisors about the merits of the deal, heightening suspicions that the money is paid back for Kushner's defense of Bin Salman in the wake of the gruesome 2018 murder of Jamal Khashoggi. The United Nations and U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Bin Salman, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, likely approved the Khashoggi assassination. As a top aide to Donald Trump, Jared Kushner spent years building ties and currying favor with Saudi Arabia, said Noah Bookbinder, the president of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, in response to the Times' story, adding, "It's no surprise that an investment fund tied to the Saudi crown prince invested billions in Kushner's fund, even though advisors raised objections." Journalist Jude Legum added on Twitter, "Let's be very clear. Jared Kushner used his position in the White House to advance Saudi interests, including making sure Saudi wouldn't be held accountable for the brutal murder of a U.S.-based journalist," Legum wrote, "and now he is cashing in." According to the Times, the objections raised by the Saudi fund's advisory panel included the inexperience of the Affinity Fund management, the possibility that the kingdom would be responsible for the bulk of the investment and risk, due diligence on the fledgling firm's operations that found them unsatisfactory in all aspects, a proposed asset management fee that seems excessive, and public relations risks from Mr. Kushner's prior role as a senior advisor to his father-in-law. But days after the panel outlined its concerns, the full board of the $620 billion fund, which the Times notes is led by Bin Salman, dismissed them and signed off on the investment in Kushner's firm. The Times also revealed that Kushner was not the only official from Trump's White House to receive Saudi money after the former president was voted out of office in 2020. Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin's new private equity firm, Liberty Strategic Capital, has received $1 billion from the same Saudi fund that invested in Kushner's outfit. The Saudi fund agreed to invest twice as much and on more generous terms with Mr. Kushner than it did at about the same time with former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Even though Mr. Mnuchin had a record as a successful investor before entering government, the Times noted. Despite public outcry over the regime's continued human rights abuses, a spokesperson for Kushner's firm told The Times that it is proud to have the Saudi fund as an investor. Affinity's latest public filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission show that the firm's primary fund has $2.5 billion under management, the bulk of which appears to be from Saudi Arabia. The Times report, which came as Trump is gearing up for another presidential bid in 2024, drew the attention of at least one U.S. senator. Senator Chris Murphy, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, tweeted, "Just because the breathtaking corruption occurs in public doesn't make it not breathtaking."
The last last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session, and we